This is Kirk Benrood with the Triangle Radio Reading Service with another edition of Did You Know?
This is Pam Vesper. This program is designed for a print and visually impaired audience.
And this is Bob Martin. And did you know that appearances are deceiving? Things aren't always the way they seem. They just look that way.
Well, there are some appearances that aren't deceiving. And one of those is that Pam is all smiles today. Pam, what are the smiles all about, huh? As my grandma used to say, you look like the cat that swallowed the canary.
Pam ate a bird?
Yes, I ate a bird. It tasted like a condor with the texture of spotted owl. Now, what kind of bird was it?
Pam, don't tell him that. Remember what happened when you told him that the cow jumped over the moon?
Oh, yeah. I found him in my cupboard with a handful of silverware.
Hey, I did find a dog at the zoo that laughed.
It was a hyena, Bob. And no, she didn't really eat a bird. It's just an expression for her smile today. No, come on, Pam. Why the smiles?
Well, guys, I can't deny the smiles. I am so jacked up about all the pirate stories, especially the ones about the women pirates.
Did you know that the Pittsburgh Baseball Club got its name, the Pirates, because of all the players they stole from other teams?
Bob, what has that got to do with being thrilled with female pirates?
I don't know. I just thought I ought to say something.
Remember what the Commissioner of Baseball said. Put on your baseball cap and sit there quietly until asked.
The Commissioner of Baseball said that?
Yes, she did.
Oh, okay. What about the female pirates?
In school, did anyone ever talk about them? You heard all about Blackbeard and Captain Kidd and Jean Lafitte, but did you ever once hear about Anne Bonny or Mary Read? Compared to them, Captain Kidd was a wuss.
We'll have to look into that sometime.
Put your hand down. Take off your ball cap. What is it?
I don't think I would have asked Anne Bonny to the senior prom.
Would you have asked Blackbeard? That's not the point. Think of all the things women could do if you let them.
I agree with you there.
I wanted to find out everything about them that I could.
That's right. She went and tried to rent all of the Pirates of the Caribbean movies.
And did you?
No, they wouldn't rent them to me.
Because they feature Captain Jack Sparrow, and that's a bird.
No, Bob. It was because they were rated R.
Oh, the guy at the video store was just mistaken.
That's right. To err is human, but to R is pirate.
Well, Pam asked me what kind of material to get for a headband.
Argyle.
But she asked me what Blackbeard 13's wife's name was.
Peg.
She asked why pirates don't eat corn.
Because a buck an ear is too expensive.
And if she were a pirate, she'd like to paint while on board.
Then go to an art supply store.
And how would pirates respond to her if she were the captain wearing her patch?
Aye, aye, ma'am.
And what food should be served to a pirate every night?
Artichokes.
All right, you guys. You know, of course, that those jokes are just arful.
Well, sorry. But do you know why we did it?
Because we could.
Yes.
I knew that. Anyway, the sound of R is like music to my ears.
Speaking of music, do we have any musical did you knows?
Of course. Let's start close to home. Did you know that, including Tom Dooley, that we talked about several weeks ago, North Carolina has some other characters that through song and legend have become part of our state's folklore?
The first is Otto Wood. Otto was a native of Wilkes County. It is said that he lost his left hand in a railroad accident while he was working as a brakeman. His criminal activity began in Greensboro in 1923 when he killed a pawnbroker named A.W. Kaplan.
Seems that Otto was a little short of money and went into the pawn shop to pawn a pocket watch that had belonged to his father. He told Mr. Kaplan that he would be back in a few days to redeem the watch because he wanted it back. Supposedly, Kaplan said that he held merchandise for a month before selling them. That didn't hold true because when Wood came back in a few days, the watch had been sold. An argument ensued and Wood hit Kaplan in the head with the barrel of his gun and killed him.
Wood was sentenced to prison since he wasn't a premeditated murder. During the ensuing years, Wood made several daring jailbreaks, and that, in part, led to his legend status. Finally, with a $500 reward on his head, he was shot and killed in a gun battle in Salisbury in 1930 by Lee Rankin, the chief of police. Knowing the family had no money, the people of Salisbury took up a collection to get poor old Otto a new suit and ship him back to his mother in Carbondale, West Virginia.
One version of his vocal legend goes like this. Step up, buddies, and listen to my song. I'll sing it to you right, but you might sing it wrong. all about a man named Otto Wood. I can't tell you all, but I wish I could.
He walked in a pawn shop a rainy day with the clerk. He had a quarrel, they say. Pulled out a pistol and he struck him a blow, and this is the way the story goes.
They spread the news as fast as they could. The sheriff served a warrant on Otto Wood. The jury said murder in the second degree, and the judge passed sentence to the penitentiary.
They put him in the pen, but it did no good. It wouldn't hold the man they call Otto Wood. It wasn't very long till he slipped outside, drawed a gun on the guard, and said, "Take me for a ride."
Second time they caught him was way out west in the hold-up game. He got shot through the breast. They brought him back, and when he got well, they locked him down in a dungeon cell.
He was a man that could not run. He always carried a .44 gun. He loved the women, and he hated the law, and he just wouldn't take anybody's jaw.
He rambled out west, and he rambled all round. He met a sheriff in a southern town, and the sheriff says, "Otto, step this way, 'cause I've been expecting you every day."
He pulled out his gun, and then he said, "If you make a crooked move, you'll both fall dead. Crank up your car and take me out of town," and a few minutes later, he was graveyard bound.
Otto, why wouldn't you run? Otto's done dead and gone. Otto Wood, why didn't you run when the sheriff pulled out his .44 gun?
Did you know that one of the most popular of religious songs has a very interesting story of origin?
Which song is that?
Listen to the story and see if you can guess. On May 10th, 1748, John Newton, a sailor in the slave trade, was heading home to England when his ship ran into a storm. It was a bad storm, so bad that water was pouring over the decks and into the holds. Newton pumped water for 9 straight hours, and still the storm raged.
His strength was giving out, and in what he thought might be a final act of desperation, he shouted out, "Lord, have mercy on us!" Shortly after that, the weather started to clear and the ship limped back into port.
Newton had never been a religious man. Along with the slave trade, he was a gambler, a drinker, and he could curse a streak so blue that other slave traders turned away. Convinced that his prayers had been answered, he gave up drinking and gambling and swearing on the spot. He became an evangelical Christian. Years later, when ill health forced him to leave the sea, he met the Wesley brothers and became a minister in the Church of England.
Well, and of course, he renounced the slave trade.
Well, of course not. That's business. Some people believe that the tragedy of slavery was uppermost in Newton's mind when he wrote the song. They wanted to believe this former slave trader so repented his actions that he wrote this piece in atonement for his past life. Well, did you know that although he gave up gambling, drinking, and swearing, he immediately returned to the slave trade?
He worked his way up to captain of his own ship, delivering his human cargo to English ports in America in the Caribbean, while at the same time spending his free time in prayer. It wasn't until 1788, when anti-slavery sentiment was sweeping England, that he spoke against slavery. And although he lived until 1808 and composed 280 hymns, he never wrote a hymn about anti-slavery.
In December of 1772, he composed a hymn which he entitled Faith's Review and Expectations. Any idea of what its more popular title is?
Rock of Ages?
Nope.
Amazing Grace.
Amazing Grace. So popular it has been recorded 100 times and mistakenly even believed to be an old Southern gospel spiritual.
Did you know in the 200 plus years since it was written, it has become a theme for different groups struggling against injustice? It was sung by both sides of the Civil War, both sides of the 1960 civil rights demonstrations. It was even sung by the Cherokee Indians on the Trail of Tears during the 1830s.
Amazing Grace, how sweet the sound, that saved a wretch like me. I once was lost, but now am found, was blind, but now I see.
Shout, shout for glory, shout, shout aloud for glory, brother, sister, mourner, all shout glory, hallelujah.
But apparently, never once did it occur to Newton that it might apply to slavery.
Did you know that during their lifetimes, Beethoven wrote 120 hours of music, Bach wrote 170 hours, and Mozart, 240?
Yay, go!
Did you know that Mozart's opera Don Giovanni was written in one sitting and then performed the next day with no rehearsal?
Did you know that Bach, during his lifetime, was more respected as an organist than a composer?
And did you know that if Beethoven had been killed in a plane crash at the age of 22, it would have changed the course of music and aviation?
Don't ask. But did you know that I had an uncle that became obsessed with Beethoven?
You had an uncle, too?
Remember, he said don't ask.
He read books on Beethoven's life, bought recordings of all 120 hours of his music, and listened to them over and over again. He had pictures of Beethoven all over his house and even had Beethoven magnets on his refrigerator door. His life revolved around Beethoven. Once he found an old manuscript for sale in a second-hand store and, believe it or not, suddenly decided that he had to go to Vienna and visit Beethoven's grave. Day after day, he would go to the gravesite and just stand there. Then another terrible thought came to him. He knew that Beethoven's body had been previously moved. What if it wasn't really there? This idea so terrified him that finally one night, in a dense fog, he took a shovel and dug up the gravesite. When he pried the lid off the casket and peered inside with his flashlight, he saw a tiny man at one end of the casket, sitting at a tiny piano, with a tiny candelabra at the top of the piano. The figure had stacks of music, and he was erasing it. My uncle said, "Ludwig?" Beethoven said, "Ja, what are you doing?" Beethoven replied, "I am decomposing." And that really happened.
Maybe that's why we only have 120 hours of music.
Did you know that also on the piano was a metronome invented by Dietrich Winkel in 1812 and first used by Beethoven?
Oh, dear.
Did you know how long we've had music?
Pretty much from the beginning, I guess.
That would be a pretty good guess.
Did you know there is not a single race on Earth where music is not an important part of the culture? Some think that our earliest music, back in prehistoric days, was an attempt to produce the sounds we heard around us, like the wind whistling through caves and trees and animals howling and birds singing.
That's right. According to Chinese mythology, the inventor of music was Lin Lun, whose pipes imitated the sounds of birds.
People could make rhythms by clapping their hands or beating on rocks and logs with sticks.
And as they progressed, they were able to fashion crude instruments out of all kinds of substances.
In fact, the oldest shaped instrument is believed to be a Neanderthal flute, a 5-inch long hollow section of a bear's thigh with four holes bored into it of equal diameter. Some archaeologists say these holes align perfectly with what would be the notes on a diatonic scale, like do, re, mi.
That bone was found in 1998 in a cave in Slovenia, and it is about 45,000 years old, making it the oldest instrument by 30,000 years.
But did you know there are some archaeologists that disagree? They say the bone has holes in it because another animal bit it, and it was just circumstance that the holes happened to line up.
While that debate goes on, known instruments are still very old. In 1999, six intact flutes were found in a cave in the Henan province in China. Carbon dating puts them at between 700 to 9,000 years old, and some of them are still playable.
Did you know there was a clay tablet found in Iraq that dated back to the 26th century BCE? That's more than 4,600 years ago. This tablet was inscribed with symbols showing 26 different musical instruments, including stringed instruments. And these symbols also describe the tuning of the instruments and the intervals between them.
And did you know, in 4000 BCE, basic zithers and flutes were being played in China and India. And by about 1500 BCE, a text was found in Syria. And when it was finally deciphered in 1972 at UC Berkeley, they found it contained a song written in harmony. And did you know, there's a 3,300-year-old stone that shows a Hittite band playing an instrument that looks just like a guitar.
From then on, musical improvements were rapid. By 1000 BCE, psalm singing was a regular part of Jewish worship. The Bible even says that King David played the harp. By 600 BCE, Pythagoras discovered the concept of the octave. The precursor of the pipe organ was in existence in Greece around 200 CE.
In 521, Boethius wrote his Principle of Music. Charlemagne codified Gregorian chant, and plain song in 810. A four-line staff was developed in 1025. The five-line staff was introduced in France in 1500.
And in 1500 in Florence, a group of musicians, believing that music had been too complex and unintelligible, set about correcting that problem and ended up inventing opera.
Opera sure simplified music.
Sure. Did you know that opus is the singular? Opera is the plural, which, by the way, is another singular word for which operas is the plural. One work, opus. Many works, opera. Carmen, one opera. Carmen and Giovanni, two operas. Simple, yeah?
Anyway, now we all have all kinds of music and all kinds of instruments. I'll tell you about some different kinds of instruments later, but now rest in the knowledge that music hath charm that soothes the savage breast.
Did you know that because of that influence, music is pumped into stressful locations, like elevators, or the workplace, or the grocery store? The mood music isn't there just to make you feel good. It's there to make you spend more.
Did you know that there's a specialty in psychology called atmospherics? Everything within a store, the paint on the wall, the placement of items, the lighting, the music, that is designed to keep you in the store and make you buy more.
And if you could keep a shopper inside a supermarket longer, the shopper would spend an additional $1.89 per minute.
So, besides the music designed to keep you in the store longer, did you know these other things about your trips to the grocery store?
Besides the fact that I can never find what I'm looking for, and if you have a child along to help shop, you end up at the check-in counter with things you don't remember putting in the cart?
Hey, did you know they are future shoppers in training?
Don't say it. There are children present. So did you know the shopping secrets? The produce is over here. The dairy's over there. The soft drink specials are at the end of the aisles. It's laid out so you'll spend as much as they want you to spend.
The first thing in the door is usually the produce, always beautifully displayed. 10% of the floor space, 20% of the store's profits. Meat, poultry, and seafood displays are almost always along the back of the supermarket, so you will see them every time you come out of an aisle. Not a bad place to put the most profitable sections.
The dairy is usually in the back of the store. Everybody buys milk, so you have to walk by everything else, often along the perimeter, just to get to the milk. It's estimated that about half a store's profits come from perimeter items, produce, milk, and cheese, meat, poultry, and fish. Stores like to anchor popular items at opposite ends of the display. Milk at one end, butter and margarine at the other.
And all the items in the middle that you have to go by in order to get to what you came in for. Don't forget to watch the scanner and check your receipt. You might be surprised at the mistakes a scanner can make. This information came from a Nutrition Action Health letter in 1994.
How about an O. Henry story while we rest our shopping lists?
Memoirs of a Yellow Dog. I don't suppose it will knock any of you people off your perch to read a contribution from an animal. Mr. Kipling and a good many others have demonstrated the fact that animals can express themselves in remunerative English, and no magazine goes to press nowadays without an animal story in it, except the old-style monthlies that are still running a picture of Brian and the Montpellier Horror. But you needn't look for any stuck-up literature in my piece, such as Beru the Bear and Snake-U the Snake and Tamanu the Tiger, talking the Jungle Books. A yellow dog that spent most of its life in a cheap New York flat, sleeping in a corner on the old sateen underskirt, the one she spilled port wine on the Lady Longershoreman's banquet, mustn't be expected to perform any tricks with the art of speech. I was born a yellow pup, date, locality, pedigree, and weight unknown. The first thing I can recollect, an old woman had me in a basket at Broadway and 23rd trying to sell me to a fat lady. Old Mother Hubbard was boosting me to beat the band of as a genuine Pomeranian, Hambletonian, Red Irish, Cochin China, Stoke Pocus Fox Terrier. The fat lady chased V around among the samples of gross grain flannelette in her shopping bag till she cornered it and gave it up. From that moment I was a pet. A mama's own Wootsie Squidlums. Say, gentle reader, Did you ever have a 200-pound woman breathing a flavor of camembert cheese and peau d'espion pick you up and wallop her nose all over you, remarking all the time in an Emma Eames tone of voice, "Oo's, oo, oodlum, doodlum, woodlum, toodlum, bitsy, witsy, scoodlums"? Well, from pedigreed yellow pup, I grew up to be an anonymous yellow cur looking like a cross between an Angora cat and a box of lemons. But my mistress never tumbled. She thought that the two primeval pups that Noah chased into the ark were but a collateral branch of my ancestors. It took two policemen to keep her from entering me in the Madison Square Garden for the Siberian Bloodhound Prize. I'll tell you about that flat. The house was an ordinary thing in New York, paved with Parian marble in the entrance hall and cobblestones above the first floor. Our flat was three, well, not flights, climbs up. My mistress rented it unfurnished and put in the regular things, 1903 antique upholstered parlor set, oil chromo of geishas in the harem tea house, rubber plant, and husband. By Sirius, there was a biped I felt sorry for. He was a little man with sandy hair and whiskers and a good deal like mine. Henpecked? Well, toucans and flamingos and pelicans all had their bills in him. He wiped the dishes and listened to his mistress tell about the cheap, ragged things her lady with a squirrel-skin coat on the second floor hang out on the line to dry. And every evening, while she was getting supper, she made him take me out on the end of a string for a walk. If men knew how women pass the time when they're alone, they'd never marry. Laura Leangibby, a peanut brittle and little almond cream on the neck muscles, dishes unwashed, half an hour's talk with the iceman, reading a package of old letters, a couple of pickles and two bottles of malt extract, 1 hour peeking through a hole in the window shade with a flat across the air shaft, that's about all there is to it. 20 minutes before time for him to come home from work, she straightens up the house, fixes a rat so it won't show, and gets out a lot of sewing for a 10-minute bluff. I led a dog's life in that flat. Most all day I lay there in my corner watching that fat woman kill time. I slept sometimes and had pipe dreams about being out chasing cats into basements and growling at old ladies with black mittens, as a dog was intended to do. Then she would pounce upon me with a lot of those driveling poodle palaver and kissed me on the nose. But what could I do? A dog can't chew cloves. I began to feel sorry for hubby. Dogs, my cats if I didn't. And looked so much like the people noticed it when we went out. So we shook the streets that Morgan's cab drives down and took to climbing the piles of last December's snow on the streets where cheap people live. One evening, when we were thus promenading, and I was trying to look like a prize St. Bernard, and the old man was trying to look like he wouldn't have murdered the first organ grinder he heard played in Mendelssohn's wedding march, I looked at him and said, in my way, "What are you looking so sour about, you oakum-tribbed lobster? She don't kiss you. You don't have to sit on her lap and listen to talk that would make the book of the musical comedy sound like the maxims of Epictetus. You ought to be thankful you're not a dog. Brace up, Benedict, and bid the blues be gone." The matrimonial mishap looked down at me with almost canine intelligence in his face. "Well, doggy," says he, "good doggy, you almost look like you could speak. What is it, doggy? Cats?" Cats could speak. But, of course, he couldn't understand. Humans were denied the speech of animals. The only common ground of communication upon which dogs and men can get together again is in fiction. In her flat across the hall from us lived a lady with a black and tan terrier. Her husband strung it and took it out every evening, but he always came home cheerful and whistling. One day I touched noses with a black and tan in the hall, and I stuck up for him for an elucidation. "See here, Wiggle and Skip," I says, "you know that they ain't the nature of a real man to play dry nurse to a dog in public. I never saw one leashed to a bow-wow yet that didn't look like he'd have to lick every other man that looked at him. But your boss comes in every day as perky and set up as an amateur prestidigitator doing the egg trick. How does he do it? Don't tell me he likes it." "Him?" says the black and tan. Well, he uses nature's own remedy. He gets spifficated. At first, when we go out, he's as shy as a man on the steamer who would rather play Pedro than they make him look them all up the jackpots. But by the time we've been in 8 saloons, he don't care whether the thing at the end of the line is a dogfish or a catfish. I've lost 2 inches of my tail trying to sidestep those swinging doors. The pointer I got from the terrier, vaudeville, please copy, set me to thinking. One evening, about 6 o'clock, my mistress ordered him to get busy and do the ozone act for the lovely. I have concealed it until now, but that is what she called me. The black and tan was called tweetness. I consider that I have a bulge on him so far as you could chase a rabbit. Still, lovey is something of a nomenclature tin can on the tail of one's self-respect. At a quiet place on a safe street, I tightened the line of my custodian in front of an attractive, refined saloon. I made a dead-ahead scramble for the doors, whining like a dog in the press. Dispatches that lets the family know that little Alice is bogged while gathering lilies in the brook. Well, darn my eyes, said the old man with a grin. Darn my eyes if the saffron-colored son of a seltzer lemonade ain't asking me to take a drink. Let me see. How long's it been since I saved shoe leather by keeping 1 foot on the footrest? I believe I knew I had him. Hot scotch as he took sitting at the table. For an hour he kept the Campbells coming. I sat by his side, rapping for the waiter with my tail and eating free lunch such as Mama in her flat never equaled with her homemade truck bought in at the delicatessen store 8 minutes before Papa came home. When the products of Scotland were all exhausted except the rye bread, the old man unwound me from the table leg and played me outside like a fisherman plays a salmon. Out there he took off my collar and threw it in the street. Poor doggie, he said. Now, good doggie. She shan't kiss you any more. Be a darn shame. Good doggie, go away and get run over by a streetcar and be happy. I refused to leave. I leaped and frisked around the old man's leg and happier than a pug on a rug. You old flea-bit woodchucker chaser, I said to him. You moon-band, rabbit-pointing, egg-stealing old beagle, can't you see that I don't want to leave you? Can't you see that we're both pups in the wood and the missus is the cruel uncle after you with the dish towel and me with the flea liniment and the pink bow to the tie on my tail? Why not cut that all out and be pards forevermore? Well, now, maybe you'll say he didn't understand. Maybe he didn't. But he kind of got a grip on the hot scotches and stood still for a minute thinking. Doggy, says he, we don't live more than a dozen lives on this earth, and very few of us live to be more than 300. If ever I see that flat anymore, I'm a flat. And if you do, you're flatter, and there's no flattery. I'm offering 60-1 that Westwind Hold wins out by the length of the dash-hound. There was no string, but I frolicked along with my master to the 23rd Street Ferry, and the cats on the route saw reason to give thanks that prehensile claws had been given to them. On the Jersey side, my master said to a stranger who was standing eating currant buns, me and my doggie were bound for the Rocky Mountains. But what pleased me most was when my old man pulled both of my ears until I howled, and he said, you common monkey-eared, rat-tailed, sulfur-colored son of a doormat, do you know what I'm going to be calling you? I thought of Lovely, and I whined it hopefully. I'm going to call you Pete, said my master. And if I'd had 5 tails, I could have done enough wagging to do justice to the occasion.
That reminds me of one of my aunts.
Oh, what was her name?
Aunt Polly. Anyway, she used to tell me about 2 families that lived on either side of her years ago out in Garner. They were the Franks and the Bennets. Now, these families were as close as ever could be expected. They were so close that nobody in the neighborhood was a bit shocked when it came time to start their families that Mrs. Franks and Mrs. Bennett had their babies at the same hospital on the same day at exactly the same time. What do you think of that? The Franks named their son Sam. The Bennets named their son Tony. As was to be expected, these two boys were inseparable. They did everything together. Same sports, same hobbies, same classes together. All through grade school, middle school, high school. They even end up marrying twin sisters. And then bought two houses right next to each other, directly across the street from their parents. And of course, Aunt Polly. Their kids used to come over to Polly's for lemonade and crackers on hot days. One day, many years later, Sam died. 2 days later, Tony died of a broken heart. He arrived outside the celestial entrance, of course was escorted right in, and promptly received his wings and his halo and his own harp with his name engraved on it. Next, he went looking for Sam, but he couldn't find him anywhere. He came back to the celestial gate and asked where he might find Sam. He was told, "I'm sorry, Sam is not with us. He's down below." Tony was devastated. "Why not?" he asked. "Ours is not to know everything that has been decided." Tony wanted to know if there's anything that he might be able to do to see him. He was told, "A great chasm has been established that may not be crossed, but it is possible just once to descend. But you must be back before midnight, and you have to bring your harp with you for identification." Promising to adhere to the conditions, off Tony went to see his friend. When he reached the bottom of the escalator, the first thing he saw was gold-fronted buildings with flashing neon lights that spelled out, "Sam Franks! Sam Franks! Sam Franks!" Inside were strobe lights and girls dancing in leather outfits and high boots, a plush bar with a name overhead, "Sam's a Go-Go." On the other side of the room was a gold door and a sign that said, "Private." He knocked hesitantly and looked in. There was Sam, seated before a huge gold and red desk. "Tony, come on in! I've been waiting for you!" Tony said, "Sam, I don't understand." Sam replied, "I know, up there I was always that good man, but this is the real me. I know you couldn't live like this, but you're here now, and I know you've got until midnight, so let me show you around." They had a wonderful time talking and reminiscing, and Tony was totally relaxed, when all of a sudden he heard, "Bong, bong, bong." "Oh my goodness, I have to go." "Bong, bong." "I'll never see you again." "Bong, bong." "Goodbye," called Sam. "Hurry." "Bong," as Tony headed for the escalator. "Bong, bong." Taking two and three steps at a time. "Bong, bong." As he reached the top and sped for the gate. "Bong," as he slid his foot past the closing gate. "Wait, don't close it. I'm back." "Who are you?" came the stern voice. "I'm Tony. Tony Bennett. I belong here." "If you belong here, where's your harp?" Panic shot across his face. "My harp! Oh no, my harp! I left my harp in Sam Frank's disco." "That's a true story. My Aunt Polly told it to me."
"Kurt, why are you banging your head on the desk?"
"Because it will feel better when I stop."
"It really happened."
"Right."
"Well, while you get your fingers out of the desk drawer, did you know that music doesn't always have a soothing effect? When Frank Sinatra sang, the audiences were anything but calm, right?"
"Right. But there's a strange beginning to the Sinatra story. The year is 1942, and Sinatra is booked to perform at the Paramount Theater in New York. Up to this point, Frank's career had been modest, but this night was going to be different.
A couple of nights earlier, Sinatra's press agent, George Evans, had seen a girl throw a rose on stage during Frank's performance, and that gave him an idea. If he could get girls to do that every night, he might have something. So Evans went out and hired 12 girls and paid them $5 each to sit in the front row and swoon. Some were taught to scream and even faint in the aisles when Frank sang "Embraceable You." Evans even hired an ambulance to wait in front and carry the girls away when they pass out.
It was a screaming success. It was a fainting success. Well, anyway, it worked. Evans had hired 12 girls, but the power of suggestion kicked in and the whole place went crazy. The swooning and the carrying on only got bigger. In fact, the next time Sinatra played at the Paramount Theater, the girls were throwing a lot more than roses. So a whole tradition was born from what started out as a publicity stunt.
And all the time you thought it was for real. Well, did you know that in 2003, in the Beethoven Orchestra in Bonn, Germany, during a rehearsal, a violinist admitted to a fellow violinist that he had hit a wrong note? A few minutes later, when he hit the same wrong note again, the second fellow punched him. Then the other musicians took sides and joined in. An orchestra-sized brawl out.
In the middle of the fight, did a hockey game break out?
No, but the violinist who threw the first punch was fined the equivalent of $600. Oh, by the way, it was a public rehearsal.
How about a bad night at the opera? In fact, not only bad, but lethal. In the opera Tosca, two soldiers are to execute Cavaradossi, while Tosca watches in horror. Did you know that in a performance in San Francisco in 1961, the director had so little time to rehearse the firing squad, so he instructed them to march on stage when he cued them, wait until the officer lowers his sword and hollers, "Shoot," and then fire their guns. When they asked how they were supposed to exit, the director told them to simply exit with the principals.
When they marched on, they were amazed to see two people standing up against the execution wall, Cavaradossi and Tosca. They hadn't been told which one to shoot. So when the officer hollered, "Shoot," they shot Tosca. Wrong. Cavaradossi, 20 yards away, fell to the stage, while the person they had just shot raced across the stage weeping and crying in Italian. Then Tosca climbs to the top of the castle battlements to leap to her death. Being told to exit with the principals, they ran up the battlements and jumped off after her. Her jump was staged. Theirs wasn't, and they both were killed.
Or how about this? Did you know that in 1849, Charles VI was premiering in Paris? At the beginning of the aria, which is entitled, "O God, Kill Him," a member of the opera company fell dead. The next night, at the same point in the production, a member of the audience keeled over. At the third performance, at the same spot, the orchestra leader dropped dead. Napoleon forbade any further performances.
Warnings about karaoke, if we need them. In August of 2007, a man in a bar in Seattle, Washington, had just started singing Yellow by the band Coldplay, when a woman in the audience started yelling, "I can't stand that song!" She then jumped up on the stage and started punching the singer. The woman was subdued by members of the audience, and the police were called and arrested her. Do you know what the charge was?
All right. In July of 2007, a man in the Shangri-La bar in Liverpool, England, was singing karaoke when the crowd started heckling him. He walked off the stage directly into the audience and started punching one of the hecklers in the face, causing an injury that required 40 stitches. Likewise, this person was arrested. Do you know what the charge was?
And in August 2005, an English tourist in Burgas, Bulgaria, attacked two men who were singing a version of Queen's "We Are the Champions." He told police he attacked them for bad singing. He was arrested. And did you know what the charge was?
And finally, as of 2007, the song "My Way," made famous by Frank Sinatra, had been pulled off of practically all karaoke machines in Manila in the Philippines. Newspapers reported that drunken, out-of-tune versions had been the source of hundreds of fights and scores of arrests. Did you know what the charges were? Karaoke-related assault. That's pretty specific.
All right, before our last non-soothing music story, did you know the difference between a dead trombonist in the road and a dead skunk in the road? The skunk may have been on his way to a gig.
And Richard Strauss once said, "Never look at the trombone section. It only encourages them."
Now look, it's not that we're picking on trombone players, but my son is a professional trombone player, and so I can say from personal experience that they march to a different drummer. That is, if they even know the drummer's there. Now, this story was sent by my son, the trombone player. In August of 1998, the Sinfonica Mayor de Uruguay was performing the 1812 overture as a part of a children's concert. Paulo Esperanza, bass trombonist, decided to make his own contributions to the cannon shots fired at the conclusion of the overture.
In complete seriousness, he placed a large ignited firecracker, which was equivalent to a quarter stick of dynamite, into his aluminum straight-line mute, and then stuck the mute into the bell of his quite new Yamaha inline double-valve bass trombone.
Later, from his hospital bed, through bandages around his mouth, he tried to explain to a reporter. He said, "I thought that the bell of the trombone would shield me from the explosion, focusing the energy of the blast outwards and away from me, propelling the mute high above the orchestra. What actually happened should serve to all during those delirious moments of divine inspiration."
First, because he failed to sufficiently elevate the bell of the trombone, the blast propelled a mute between the rows of players in the woodwind and viola sections of the orchestra and right into the stomach of the conductor, driving him off the podium and into the front row of the audience. Now, fortunately, the audience was sitting in folding chairs, and thus they were saved from serious injury, and the rows of chairs began to collapse from the weight of the flying conductor, like dominoes. Row after row of wooden chairs collapsed, adding to the sound of the grunts and the groans of the people falling back on their rears, the sound increasing logarithmically, adding to the overall sound of brass cannons and brass playing, which constitutes the closing measures of the overture.
Meanwhile, back on stage, Paulo said that after the sound of the blast, everything seemed to go into slow motion, and he could swear that he could hear a voice in Austrian saying, "For every action, there is an equal and opposite reaction."
Well, having failed to plug the lead pipe of his trombone, the energy of a blast sent a jet of superheated gas backward through the mouthpiece, burning his lips and face. But also, the force of the blast was so great that it split the bell of his new Yamaha right down the middle, turning it inside out, while at the same time propelling Paulo backward off the riser. As he fell backwards, he lost his grip on the slide, allowing the pressure still running through the trombone to propel the slide off the trombone and right into the head of the third clarinetist, knocking him unconscious.
Whether that story is really true or not, the moral certainly is. If you hear someone in the trombone section holler, "Hey, what's this?" Beware.
Another person to have been brought to prominence through folk song was a young girl named Naomi Wise, referred to in the folklore as Little Omi. What little we know of her in real life is this. Records indicate that she was an orphan girl who was taken in by William Adams and his wife, Mary, who lived in Randolph County. Jonathan Lewis, the son of Richard Lewis, met her at the Adams place, and they soon became lovers. Jonathan's mother disapproved of the match because of her social standing, and instead told her son to take up with Hetty Elliott, a young lady of good social and financial status. Naomi found out about this courtship and, though jilted, did not break off the relationship with Jonathan.
This relationship continued until he learned that Naomi was pregnant. So somewhere in April 1808, Naomi went missing. Her father and others went searching for her and followed horse prints to Ashboro, where they found her body in a river. Not only did the coroner discover the pregnancy, but he also found that she had been beaten quite a bit. Stories were that he'd been mean to Naomi. Lewis was arrested and taken to jail, but a month later he escaped and fled to Kentucky.
As notoriety grew around the case, more of Lewis's family migrated to Kentucky. It was 6 years later that his whereabouts was determined. And it was also discovered they had started another family in Kentucky. He was brought back and stood trial in Guilford County in 1815. But despite evidence, he was found not guilty, and he returned to Kentucky. In 1820, he died of an illness and confessed to the murder on his deathbed. Naomi is buried at Providence Quakers Church Cemetery in Randolph County. Here are the words of the legend of Omi Wise.
I'll tell you a story about Omi Wise. How she was deluded by John Lewis' lies. He proposed to marry her at Adams Spring. He gave her some money and other fine things.
He gave her no money, but flattered the case. Says, "We'll get married. There'll be no disgrace." She got up behind him. Away they did go. They rode till they came where the deep river flowed.
"Now, Omi, little Omi, I'll tell you my mind. My mind is to drown you and leave you behind. Oh, pity your poor infant and spare me my life. Let me go home rejected and not be your wife."
"No pity, no pity," the monster did cry. "On deep river's bottom your body will lie." The wretch, he did choke her, as we understand. He threw her in the river below the mill dam.
Now Omi is missing, as we all know, and down to the river a hunting will go. Two little boys were fishing just at break of dawn. They spied poor Omi's body came floating along.
They arrested John Lewis. They arrested him today. they buried poor Omi down in the cold clay. Go hang me or kill me, for I am the man who murdered Naomi below the mill dam.
We promised you a few examples of strange instruments, so here goes. Did you know the origin of the trombone was an instrument called the sackbut?
How about the harpsichord? It had its roots from a dainty harp-like instrument from Greece called the psaltery. In the 1300s, a keyboard-activated device was added to the psaltery that plucked the strings with crow quills. In the 1500s, the cabinet was made larger and the string tension was increased, which gave the sound of ethereal quality. By the late 1600s, the harpsichord was the most popular instrument. Haven't heard a harpsichord lately? Did you know that what Lurch played in that old TV show, The Addams Family, was a harpsichord?
And did you know that Spike Jones of the City Slickers once had a toilet seat with strings that he called the latrinophone?
The hurdy-gurdy. It started out in Western Europe about 800 years ago and was then called the organistrum. Picture a 3-foot-long guitar-shaped instrument with a string base and a long neck with keys. A hand crank turned a wheel inside the bass, and the wheel ran over the strings much like a bow does on a violin. It took 2 people to operate, one to crank and one to play the keys. It was relegated mostly to church music.
Did you know about the barrel organ? It was a small mechanical organ originating in France about 300 years ago. It was originally used to teach songs to canaries and songbirds belonging to society ladies. The operator turned a crank that moved a barrel that opened pins that pushed air through tubes. Street entertainers saw the possibilities of the device, and if you remember the fellow turning a crank to make music and a monkey walking around through the crowd collecting coins, you heard a barrel organ.
Now, the magical thing about music is that just about anything can be used. Old mountain bands use spoons or an upside-down washing pan attached to a string and a stick to change the tension. Some fellas just slapped their legs with their hands. Bobby McFerrin performed by just using different parts of his body. P.D.Q. Bach, in reality, Professor Peter Schickele, used bicycle pumps and balloons and slide whistles. Besides his latrinophone, Spike Jones used bells, whistles, and guns.
Okay, folks, I got you here now. Think about tax day. Think about a piano. Think about a harp. A harp is just a piano after taxes.
Yes.
Anyway, how about another folk story, a song tragedy? This one wasn't from North Carolina, but right next door in Virginia. It was on May 2nd, 1929 in Rye Cove, Scott County, Virginia, just 29 miles from Kingsport, Tennessee. The Kingsport newspaper reported that the school had an enrollment of 250. Reports were that the sky suddenly darkened. The principal, Floyd Noblin, stated that he had headed for the school building when the storm worsened and was barely inside when the building just flattened.
Later, pieces of the structure were found hundreds of yards away, some suspended up in trees. To make matters worse, a fire broke out afterwards from an overturned heating stove. It was estimated that up to 90 people were injured and up to 25 may have been killed.
Now here is a folk song that was written to commemorate the tragedy. It's entitled The Cyclone of Rye Cove.
Oh, give us a home far beyond the blue sky, where storms and cyclones are unknown. And there by life's strand we'll clasp with glad hands God's children in a heavenly home. Oh, listen today in a story I tell, in sadness and tear-dimmed eye, of a dreadful cyclone that came this way and blew our schoolhouse away.
When the cyclone appeared, it darkened the air and lightning clashed over the sky. And the children all cried, "Don't take us away and spare us to go back home." There were mothers so dear and fathers the same that came to this horrible scene. Searching and crying, each found her own child dying on a pillow of stone.
Rye Cove, Rye Cove, the place of my childhood and home, where in life's early morn I once learned to roam, but now it's so silent and lone.
How about we switch to a nursery rhyme?
Here's one I'd like to know more about. Sing a song of sixpence, a pot full of rye, 4-20 blackbirds baked in a pie. When the pie was open, the birds began to sing. Wasn't that the dainty dish to set before the king?
Now, the last time we had nursery rhyme about pies, there was property deeds inside. Is that happening again?
It could be, Bob. Could be. There are always differences of opinion about interpretation of Mother Goose, and this might be as simple as eating a meal. It was an old custom to bake little clay whistles into pies with the head of the whistle shaped like a bird's head. When the pie was cooked and then cut open, the cold air outside mixed with the heat of the cooked pie and would cause the birds to whistle.
Now, that's not such an old custom. My mother used to have these, well, they were little ceramic birds' heads that she stuck into the pies before she baked them.
Well, did they whistle?
I don't remember the whistle, but I do remember that when she pulled them out of the oven, steam would come out of the bird's mouth. Now, that was pretty neat.
Also remember that eating songbirds was once considered a delicacy in England.
Well, it still is in some parts of the world.
Yes, it is. So it would not be out of the question to serve the king a royal-style pie with blackbirds baked into it.
Yeah, but that doesn't explain the second verse.
No, it doesn't. So let's add to the interpretation. Some believe that this is a story about two of Henry VIII's wives. Anne Boleyn is the maid in the garden, going about her life totally unaware that she was about to be beheaded. And the queen is Catherine of Aragon, mother of Mary Tudor. The queen is up in her own chambers, divorced, as it were, from all other action taking place around her. Which brings us to the king, in his counting house, looking at all the deeds to monasteries he had acquired.
Ha ha ha! I was right. All the deeds safely stuck inside the pies for transport to the king.
And behind the king's back, the monks, the blackbirds.
Yeah, kind of like today. School kids referring to nuns as penguins.
Just like that. The monks may have been trying to improve their own position by singing, that is, telling about items that the bishop may have tried to withhold from the king. And remember, it was Henry's actual divorce from Catherine so he could marry Anne Boleyn that was the cause of the divorce of the Roman Church from England and the breakup of the monasteries. And there you are.
I remember this little mnemonic for remembering what happened to Henry's wives.
What's that?
Divorced, beheaded, died. Divorced, beheaded, survived.
Well, what were their names?
Well, I don't know, but I remember what happened to them.
Did you know they were Catherine of Aragon, Anne Boleyn, Jane Seymour, Anne of Cleves, Catherine Howard, and Catherine Parr?
Did you know the background for some funny popular songs? In 1968, Shel Silverstein, the author of many popular children's stories and poetry like The Giving Tree and Up in the Attic and, my favorite, Lafcadio, the Lion That Shot Back. We will share that one with you in one of these programs. He was reading about the Scopes Monkey Trial of 1925. He came across the name of one of the male attorneys at the trial, whose name was Sue Hicks. The name intrigued him, and he wrote a song about a man who set out to take revenge on his father, who had saddled him with the name Sue. Some girl would giggle and my face would turn red. Some guy would laugh and I'd bust his head. Life ain't easy for a boy named Sue.
Well, Silverstein sold the song to Columbia Records, and they gave it to, of all people, Johnny Cash. And he sang it when he did a live performance at the San Quentin prison. A Boy Named Sue went to number 2 on the pop charts and number 1 on the country charts, and it became one of the Man in Black's biggest hits.
Did you know that in the 1960s, 11-year-old Robert Sherman had been sent off to summer camp at Lake Champlain in New York? He hated it. He wrote letters home pleading with his parents to come and get him, but they refused. Finally, in desperation, young Robert threw a butter knife at a fellow camper. That worked. The other boy was not hurt, but the camp called the parents and ordered the boy to be removed. The boy came home, and then, much to the surprise of all, later in the summer, young Robert wanted to go back to Camp Champlain. The boy's father was Alan Sherman, the songwriter who encapsulated the boy's turnabout in the song, "Hello, Mudda, hello, Fada, here I am at Camp Granada." Well, we don't know if Robert went back to Lake Champlain or not.
I doubt they took him back. Did you know what the largest business is in Nashville?
Oh, no-brainer, country music.
As reported in a 2007 book, Country Music, $6.1 billion, healthcare, $18.3 billion. Nashville and country music is only a third of healthcare.
Well, here's some background. In 1925, the National Life and Accident Company built a radio station, WSM, i.e., We Shield Millions. They built it in their downtown offices. They wanted free publicity. They started a one-hour show called WSM Barn Dance. It was a huge success. The Barn Dance followed an hour of classical music and opera, and one night in 1927, the announcer said, "You have been listening to an hour of grand opera, and now we are going to present Grand Ole Opry." The name stuck.
Did you know that in 1954, a little-known teenage musician played at the Opry? The venue's manager, Jim Denny, told him afterwards that he should keep his day job as a truck driver. The youngster was so upset that he never played the Opry again. His name? Elvis Presley.
Did you know that Gene Simmons of Kiss was once an elementary school teacher?
To close today, when the country was in the middle of the Great Depression, and through music, the country sought a way back to the American dream, it was sung most beautifully by Burl Ives, and it was called The Big Rock Candy Mountain.
One evening as the sun went down and the jungle fire was burning, down the track came a hobo hiking, and he said, "Boys, I'm not turning. I'm heading for a land that's far away beside the crystal fountains. So come with me, we'll go and see the Big Rock Candy Mountains."
In the Big Rock Candy Mountains, there's a land that's fair and bright, where the handouts grow on bushes and you sleep out every night, where the boxcars all are empty and the sun shines every day, on the birds and the bees and the cigarette trees, where the lemonade springs, where the bluebird sings, in the Big Rock Candy Mountains.
In the Big Rock Candy Mountains, all the cops have wooden legs, and the bulldogs all have rubber teeth, and the hens lay soft-boiled eggs. The farmer's trees are full of fruit, and the barns are full of hay. Oh, I'm bound to go where there ain't no snow, where the rain don't fall and the wind don't blow, in the Big Rock Candy Mountains.
In the Big Rock Candy Mountains, you'll never change your socks, and the little streams of alcohol come a-tricklin' down the rocks. The brakemen have to tip their hats, and the railroad bulls are blind. There's a lake of stew and of whiskey, too. You can paddle all round 'em in a big canoe in the Big Rock Candy Mountains.
In the Big Rock Candy Mountains, the jails are made of tin, and you can walk right out of them as soon as they let you in. There ain't no short-handled shovels, no axes, saws, or picks. But I'm going to stay where you sleep all day, where they hung the jerk that invented work in the Big Rock Candy Mountains.
I'll see you all this coming fall in the Big Rock Candy Mountains.
This is Kirk Benrood for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program is designed for a print and visually impaired audience.
Did you know why bagpipers march when they play? To get away from the noise!
And this is Pam Vesper. And did you know the difference between an accordion and an onion? Nobody cries when you chop up an accordion!
And this is Bob Martin. Did you know how you can tell when a stage is level? The drummer drools out of both sides of his mouth.
Goodbye!